Okay, so today I want to speak about BMS current algebra, and most of it goes back to work that I have been doing together with my students, Cédric Troussard, Hernan González, and Blaja Oblak, basically, since 2010. So I will maybe first talk about BMS symmetry, and then I will talk about the current algebra, and then maybe the last part is this central extension in four dimensions, which is the recent result. And maybe if people are interested, because some people here work in three-dimensional gravity, I will say something about 3D gravity. So maybe you have heard this talk before, so I apologize if that is the case. I would have liked to talk about something else, but the work is not finished, so I prefer to show you what really is more or less working. Okay, so this I recently learned, well, or not so recently anymore, in a conference in King's College, that this Bondi-Maslow's formula was relatively important in the history of research on gravitational radiation, because it convinced people that gravitational waves, and there was a controversy which involved even Einstein, that gravitational waves exist in full nonlinear general relativity. Of course, there's no discussion in the linearized theory, but in full general relativity, there was a controversy. And this Bondi-Maslow's showed that if an isolated system emits gravitational waves, it loses its mass, and this convinced people, and that this is in fact a nonlinear effect, and this is what convinced some people that gravitational waves exist in full GR. If you want to read about that, there is a nice review by Daniel Kenefic on this part of the history. And there's also a very beautiful quick review of the Bondi-Sachs formalism on which all these computations are based if you work in the metric formulation by Medler and Vinicourt in 2016. So this is where you can find the results. Okay, the setup is the following. One looks at, so one tries to understand what happens at future null infinity when one goes up in retarded time and gravitational radiation leaks out of the system. So a lot of the recent interest has been trying to understand what happens when one connects scry plus to scry minus, and if there is really global conservation and things like that. That is a complicated question, because this forces you to understand spatial infinity and how it matches on to null infinity. But here it's a more limited question, which was somehow the original question. One takes the system at a certain retarded time, and then one evolves up. For what I'm going to try to show, it is very useful to use complex coordinates on the celestial sphere. So one uses stereographic projections. So a stereographic projection, and then, of course, the metric on the sphere. So scry is the sphere times a line, and the metric on the sphere becomes conformally flat in these coordinates, and it makes all this conformal structure manifest. So that's quite interesting. Also, please feel free to interrupt me at any stage, because in systems which have an action principle, of course, usually conservation laws are intimately connected to symmetries, and it turns out that the relevant symmetries here are asymptotic symmetries. So they are not really the kind of global symmetries that you are used to, or they are also not gauge symmetries. They are subset of gauge symmetries, and they are the subset of gauge symmetries that leave your fall-off conditions and your asymptotic or your gauge-fixing conditions invariant. If you want to learn about asymptotic symmetries, there's no better paper to start than this 1962 paper by Sachs. And it contains all the computations. It's extremely readable. And the point is that if you compute the asymptotic symmetries for asymptotically flat spacetimes at null infinity, there's a surprise that the symmetry group is not the Poincaré group, which is what people expected, but it's a larger group, which is called the BMS group. So this is what he says, analyzing recent work of Bondi. it is shown that with reasonable boundary condition, one obtains a larger group than the Poincaré. Then the question is, how much larger is this group? And there are basically two options. So in the standard GR literature, and for very good reasons, people wanted all quantities to be globally well-defined on the sphere. If you do that, it turns out that the asymptotic symmetry algebra is the Lorentz algebra, which appears here as the globally well-defined conformal killing vectors of the celestial sphere. So if you look at how Lorentz transformations appear on the celestial sphere, they appear like this conformal kill, or the infinitesimal version is this conformal killing vector. And then there is a semi-direct product with a factor, which are angle-dependent translations, and they have been called supertranslations by the okay, once one formulates things like that, it's of course clear that after conformal field theory, one could also look at, one could remove this restriction of having all these killing vectors globally well defined and just look at local solutions to the conformal killing equation. Okay. If you look at local solutions, and you don't care that it's really a sphere, then the asymptotic symmetry algebra becomes two copies of the centerless Virasoro algebra, which we have called superrotations for an obvious reason. And they act still in a semi-direct way on the supertranslation generators, which now are no longer developed in terms of spherical harmonics on the sphere, but you also do some kind of Laurent expansion for this supertranslation generator. And then the algebra has a form which reminds you of what you find in conformal field theory books. And it's also clear that the Poincaré subalgebra is just the lowest generators of this infinite dimensional algebra that appears here. So you have the six Poincaré, the six Lorentz generators, and the four standard translation generators which you have here. Okay, let me also stress sometimes there is a misconception that superrotations come because you relax some fall-off conditions. That's not the case. It's what you really relax is the assumption that the topology is really the sphere and that you need the sphere. You are really saying that maybe you can have punctures on the sphere or you can have more general things than the sphere at scry. And this is really how one should understand this superrotation generator. Okay, and then, of course, when you have the symmetries, what you would like to construct is the associated conserved charges. Of course, this is, in general relativity, what are the right conserved charges to construct is sometimes an involved question. There is many approaches, for instance, covariant phase-space approaches, but which is not the method that we have been using, but we have an own method to work this out. But in the end, no matter how you do it, when the dust settles, you find the following expression for the time component of the BMS current. So maybe I should stress that I am not using the charge, which would be the integral of the time component. Because the charge, if you use these generators here, this super rotation and these super translation generators that I have given, which have poles on the sphere, when you try to compute the charge, it will have divergences because it has poles on the sphere. Okay, so when you, even if you put regular solutions, if you compute this kind of charges, they can, there is divergences because you are putting singular generators in your expression. But as we know, there's, yes.
So even for the lowest modes?
Not for the lowest modes, not for the lowest modes. For the ones which are not globally well-defined, precisely. So if for the supertranslation generators, which are in this F here, you use spherical harmonics expansion, not the Laurent expansion, and you use only the Möbius transformations before, then, and you have regular solutions, then of course you get numbers. You get, if you plug in, for instance, the the Kerr solution, you get the mass and the angular momentum of the Kerr solution. Right? But if you put these other generators, then in general you could have divergence. But as we learned from conformal field theory, sometimes you should not do the integrated version of the charge, or you just should look at, sometimes it's interesting to look at the local version of the charge. So you look at the currents instead of the charges. In GR, one tends to integrate in order to get numbers, but for some questions, it's even better to have the local information, I would say. Is it more or less clear what I'm saying? Okay, maybe let me say two things. So this F contains the supertranslation generators and a certain combination of the superrotation generators in general. So this psi is the conformal factor. I've changed notation a bit, but so in any case, the Ys are the superrotation generators and the Ts are the supertranslation generators. Independently of the notation, one can see that this time component of the currents has basically two pieces. This is the Bondi mass aspect.
But this is in four dimensions.
This is in four dimensions. Everything is in four dimensions. So this is the Bondi mass aspect, and it is composed of two pieces, a linear piece, which is proportional to some component of the Weyl tensor, and a nonlinear piece, which is proportional in this notation to the asymptotic part of the shear and the nuce. And this is the piece that is related to gravitational radiation. So this is the part of the mass that is done by gravitational radiation, and this is the part of the mass that you get if you compute the Schwarzschild black hole. The Schwarzschild black hole, the M, comes from psi 0,2 here. So this is the radiation part, and this is the one that you get in Kerr or in Schwarzschild. And the same thing for the angular momentum. There is the part related to gravitational radiation, and there is the part that you have in the Kerr black hole. So you have.
Do you remember the notation of psi 2, psi 1? Which component?
Well, okay, you have to go to this Newman-Penrose thing, psi 0,2. It depends with how many L's and N's you are contracting.
So how many? Which one?
I don't remember by heart, but it is completely stuck.
As many N's.
I will answer with pleasure after the seminar, but I mean, you take the vial, you hit it with the moving frame, and then it depends how many, what are the components. And it is related to peeling and to all these quantities, so they fall off. I don't remember how many. One can also do. One can also do this in the metric formulation, and then in the metric formulation is just certain components of GUU that are there. It's just because in this Newman-Penrose formalism, the conformal structure emerges naturally because it's already built for this conformal structure. That's why I'm using it here, but you should not be scared by the notation. I mean, you have a translation from all quantities here to the metric formulation, and okay, so this contains the part on the gravity waves. This is the part that you have in stationary spacetimes, for instance. Before being able to work out the current algebra, what one can do is one can work out how the asymptotic symmetries act on this, on your solution space. So in this gravitational problem, one of the successes of this null infinity approach is that people had a very good idea what is a parametrization of solution space. So you have to give certain data at Sky Plus, certain data that goes inside, and this allows you to reconstruct the full gravitational solution in the interior spacetime. It's a bit like Pfefferman-Graham, which allows you to reconstruct the solution from the boundary data, except that here you have to give data on Sky Plus and data going inside. So this is called the null characteristic initial value problem. It has been very successful in four-dimensional general relativity, I would say. And here it is similar. So this asymptotic part of the shear and the new tensor psi 02 and psi 01 are part of the data that you have to give it at scry plus. Then you complete this by the data at scry minus, and you have, you can reconstruct the solution. And since you know that your asymptotic symmetries take solutions to solutions, because it's just diffeomorphisms, it's large diffeomorphisms, but still diffeomorphisms, you can work at, and they keep the gauge in which you have solved the equations of motion, you can work out how the symmetries act on your solutions. So this is how the symmetries act on solution space. So you find, when you do this computation, you find something that reminds you again of two-dimensional conformal field theory. So you see that the asymptotic part of the shear has this following transformation law. There is the stuff that you don't have in two-dimensional conformal field theory, which is related to the retarded time and the supertranslations. But with respect to the superrotations, you see that this field has just certain dimensions, certain conformal dimensions, if you will. I also should say that this F operator is really like the D operator of complex analysis, except that you are on the sphere and you are not on the plane. So it is the correction of the complex operator when you go to the sphere. It's the covariant derivative on the sphere expressed in complex coordinates. So you see that all these fields have certain dimensions. And what is also interesting is that there are inhomogeneous terms in this transformation law. And for instance, this one is particularly interesting because it says that the new tensor is a field of conformal dimensions 2 and 0. For the superrotation part, with an inhomogeneous term, which when you do it on the plane and not on the sphere, is precisely the third order derivative of the superrotation generator. So it's really the infinitesimal Schwarzian derivative that you see in the transformation law for the new tensor. And then, for instance, the asymptotic, so this component of the Weyl tensor has weights 3/2, 3/2. There is an inhomogeneous terms. There is an inhomogeneous term which involves different components of the asymptotic of the Weyl.
There's an anomaly.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
You didn't mention that.
Sorry?
You didn't mention that.
No, I was not saying that, but I want to come to that. It is so these inhomogeneous terms are really interesting. Because, for instance, what do they say? They say something like, the Minkowski vacuum is, for instance, having all these fields zero. Sigma zero, sigma dot zero is zero in the vacuum. And so it says that these asymptotic symmetries do not preserve the BMS vacuum, if you want. So they take you from one vacuum to another, or you can begin to argue in terms of Goldstone bosons and things like that. And for instance, when you ask which of these transformations preserve the vacuum solution, you get back to the Poincaré group. If you solve the equations h squared of f equal to 0, this guy equal to 0, you find Poincaré again.
This psi
is the conformal factor. It is the conformal factor in front of the conformal killing equation, if you want. And, and in the, as I was saying, in the case of the plane, this really reduces to third order derivative because then one of these terms is absent. And it's really the third order derivative of the conformal, infinitesimal conformal transformation, exactly like you expected for the energy momentum tensor. Okay, does it answer your questions on anomalies? It's not phrased in terms of anomalies, but it is something that you wouldn't expect. And that comes from really the fact that you have a higher dimension in space-time in which you look at it and not really a three-dimensional thing. You can trace the origin of these inhomogeneous terms back to this kind of. So the ugly formula that I would like to sell you today is this formula for current algebra. And I will try to convince you that it's not an ugly formula, but a nice formula. So what are you computing now? You work out not only the time dependent, not only the time component, but all the other components of the currents, which you can do, which is a computation. And then what you do is you hit the current associated with one symmetry with the transformation associated with another symmetry. What would this correspond to? If you would be in the Hamiltonian formalism, it would correspond to taking the Poisson bracket of one symmetry generator with the other symmetry generator. Because you know that, well, the charge generates the symmetry, and so, well, it, this is how it goes in the standard Hamiltonian formula. In the covariant version, when you have a current, and you have a current algebra, what you do is you act with the symmetry, with one symmetry on the current of the other symmetry. And then you work out what happens, and usually what you expect is that the currents form a representation of the symmetry algebra. So you expect that you have the current with the commutator of the symmetries. And up to terms like this, which are in fact trivial, which can always happen because this is, if you would integrate the thing, this one would give zero. So this is like lower order boundary terms, which you always can appear in this in this kind of current algebras and which are trivial when you integrate. And then there's two terms which you do not expect. There's this term and this term. So the first term, that's a term which is related to the fact that you don't really have conserved currents, but that your currents are non-conserved because of this news that is there. It's also related to the fact that these charges are not really integrable in the sense of Wald and Zupas. So the charges, when you compute them in the linearized theory, you try to integrate them, meaning pulling out a delta. So you compute your charge around a certain background, in the linearized theory around the background, and then it turns out that it is not really the variation of something. It's a technical, thing. And the breaking is precisely related to the gravitational news, okay, which goes up. So this term here is related to the news. And this term here is a term that you know from general principle can arise. It's related to central extensions. And you know that, for instance, from your advanced classical mechanics books, that the representation of symmetries in terms of Poisson brackets of charges can have central extensions. It's not necessarily a direct representation, but there can be an H2 already classically. So it has nothing to do with the quantum central extension that come when you go from the Virasoro in the classical theory to the Virasoro in the quantum theory, but it just comes from the fact that you represent your symmetry through the Poisson bracket of the charges. So this is this central charge that can appear. There has been important examples in three dimensions in ADS3 gravity. This is the classical central extension of ADS3 gravity, which is 3L over 2G. But here, it turns out that this expression depends on the fields of your field. So it's not like in three-dimensional gravity where the central extension is just a constant, but in this case, the central extension depends on the fields itself on which the symmetry acts.
Is it central?
Sorry?
It doesn't look central. It's not central. It's not
a... Very good. It is a central extension in a Lie algebraoid, but not in a Lie algebra. But okay, it is not central in that sense because it depends on the fields, but it is still the second cohomology group of the right object. Okay, I can show you in what sense it is central, but it is not central in the standard sense. That's absolutely
so. Does that mean that it doesn't commute under whatever bracket
I would say it commutes. Well, I will show you in what sense. I think that's a technical question. It satisfies a consistency condition. And okay, it has all, it's an H2 of something, but you have to define of what. Okay, and that's what I'm going to show you. Usually, the central extension in the Lie algebra is the second cohomology group of the Lie algebra in the reals, right? Yes.
So just to the point, so J and K are anti-symmetric on psi 1 and psi 2, right?
Yes.
J and K.
Yes.
Is L anti-symmetric on that?
I don't remember. I'm not completely sure.
It's just that the left side is not anti-symmetric.
It's not. And I think L is also not, but you don't... Okay, yeah.
There's got to be something...
Yes, that's not. Yes.
Okay, and the other thing, the psi 2 is the conformal factor for the symmetry 2, right? It's
exactly.
Not the viable tensor.
No, absolutely. Sorry for the...
Just checking the notation.
Everything is clear. Also, one should see that this field-dependent central extension, if you do not have superrotations, it vanishes, in fact. Because, again, it's the third-order derivative, if you want. So it is zero if you don't have superrotations. Okay, so that's this part. Any more question on this formula? So to try to convince you that it's a good formula, I will now try to show you that it includes the Bondi mass loss formula in a certain sense. So it's really the generalization, the full generalization of the Bondi mass loss formula to the BMS current algebra. Okay, what you do to get the Bondi mass formula, so first, you are choosing for one of the generators the retarded time translation generator. So you choose d over du for one of the generators. And then this current algebra formula reduces to the statement by how much the divergence of the current is not conserved, if you want. So it tells you that the current is not conserved due to the central extension and due to the news, if you want. Okay. So that's what it reduces to. Let us forget about superrotations and say that there is no poles, that one can integrate this formula. Then these terms here, if you integrate them over the sphere, they are total derivatives on the sphere, so they give zero. And the formula after integration reduces to the statement by how much the BMS charge is not conserved. So you find that all BMS charges, the non-conservation is controlled by this right-hand side, which involves, as you can see, the news. So if there is no news, all these BMS charges are conserved. And the Bondi mass loss formula is the formula that you get when you stick in this transformation law here. For delta xi here, you stick it in, you choose xi to be equal to d over du as well, and you see you recover this Bondi mass loss formula, which says that the time evolution of the total Bondi mass, so the total Bondi mass decreases because this integrand here is always positive, as you can see. So this was one of the important results of Bondi's work, which showed that the mass always, Bondi mass always goes down. My claim is, if you like this formula, you should also like this formula. Yes?
In these formulas, is there a contribution from K? Or?
No, I dropped it because I wanted to go back to, because the formalism is capable of handling the old situation and the new one. So K is not there if you don't consider an extended algebra, but...
Okay, so if there are no poles...
Yes, exactly. K is zero. Exactly. This is what I... Okay, so this is only there and only interesting if you allow not to be on the sphere or if you do different things. Right? Otherwise, the issue doesn't arise. And that's why it's also clear that it is not there in the standard literature because it cannot be there if you're not using that. Okay, maybe now to answer your question, in what sense it is a central or a non-central extension, and what is the relation to anomalies? Okay, so in fact, I think the best analogy here is with the Adler-Bandin anomaly in four-dimensional quantum field theory, if you have chiral fermions. So it turns out that the Adler-Bardeen gauge anomaly satisfies a consistency condition which you can afterwards interpret as a consistency condition which arises when you go from a certain characteristic class to a certain primitive element, which sits here. So this is ghost number one and form degree four. This is exactly where the Adler-Bardeen anomaly sits when you do this central extension, or this extension that we have derived here, you can also package them in the same way. So it is, when you talk about consistency conditions, it's useful to promote your symmetry generators to fermionic generators, which is just a technical trick to take this anti-symmetry into account in order not to have to do it by hand. It's not a fundamental thing, it's a technical trick. And when you do that, you build out of this field-dependent object here, you build a form of form degree 2 and ghost number 2, because it has two of these symmetry generators inside. Okay, so the ghost number will be 2, the form degree will be 2, and then you can check that this object satisfies exactly a similar consistency condition. So gamma of this up to total derivative terms, which are the terms that we dropped, is equal to 0. So the integral of gamma, D sub-age is, well, it's called the horizontal D. It's the exterior derivative, except that you have to take into account how it acts on the fields of the theory. So usually it's just the ordinary D. But if you are in local field theory, it is not the local D because you're not using the Rahm cohomology, which is non-local, but you're using something which is local in field space, if you want. So that's DH.
It contains a delta?
No, it says that it's d over dx mu, but then for each, every time it hits the field, it puts an additional derivative on the field. And if you do it in local field theory, you have to prove, well, for instance, you say that if there's no topology, it's acyclic. If d of something is equal to 0, it should be the d of something. But it should be the d of something which is local in field space. And that's why you cannot use the... Okay, it's really a technical thing. People who are doing field theory do the correct object in any case. But sometimes when they are using that d of something is 0 is equal, means that this is d of something, there is a confusion which d it really is and in which space you are acting. And it's kind of important because you see, otherwise all Lagrangians, which are top forms, would be closed, and then they would be exact, so you would not have any dynamics. But of course, it's not the case in local field theory. That's the reason for the DH. Also, this is also in Wald's paper. I mean, the D that you have to use in this case is not, it's not the Rahm D. It's a field theoretic version of it.
So the gamma is presumably the BRST?
This is the BRST differential,
and
exactly.
It transforms according to the transformation laws.
Exactly. So. It transforms, so first of all, well, the way to construct it, you take the gamma of this object is the same than before, except that you replace the parameters by the ghosts. And then the rest you complete by nilpotency, how it goes on. So it's minus 1/2 CABC, CACB. The standard formula is working. Okay, so this is the consistency condition, and this is the relation to, I would say, to anomalies. It's a bit later than here. So it's one step lower than here in the consistency condition. So it's really an anomaly in the commutation relations. So there has been, so the Adler-Bardeen anomaly has been, they had the next term in this descent equation has been interpreted by Fadeev as an anomaly in commutation relations for the Gauss law. So it's really like this object from the Gauss law. We can talk more about that.
Corresponds to some kind of extension of the algebra?
Okay.
Which is not central?
Yes, that's what I'm trying to show. So, okay, central extensions. So, in all generality, if you have gauge theories which are more complicated than Young-Mills theories, you can have structure functions. So the objects here, when you compute the commutator of two gauge transformations, can be a gauge transformation with structure functions that depend on the fields of the theory and not really structure constants. Right? Okay. So, and this is the setting that we are in here. So. In that case, the standard Jacobi identity that you would derive for the structure functions is a bit more complicated because it will involve a term that depends on the fact that the Fs depend on the fields of your theory. Okay. So this is what makes it a larger set. So the object is called an algebroid, and it is really, you can imagine that it is really a Lie algebra over functions. So you have certain generators, and the functions multiplying, the objects multiplying your generators are no longer constants, but they are functions which depend on the fields, on the points where you are. And in this case, so a very easy setting to imagine this is if you take the Hamiltonian formulation of gauge theories, you take the constraints and you smear them by gauge parameters. So what happens when you take the gauge parameters to depend on the fields of your theory? Then you get exactly this kind of formulas. Okay, so this is the kind of objects that you have. So gauge symmetries are naturally Lie algebroids and not Lie algebras, even in the case, even in Young-Mills theory, where the Fs happen to not depend on the fields. Okay, and so it then turns out that this consistency condition up to this dH, so we suppose that we integrate and this dH is no longer there. So this consistency condition is really gamma of omega 2 is equal to 0 really translates into something which tells you that you can construct an extended algebroid with a central generator if you want, but the central generator is multiplied by something which depends on the fields, like the sigma 0, which is there. And then this consistency condition that you have on omega here tells you that this is again an object of this form, an extended object. So it's really the extension of Lie algebra cohomology to this set. So there is a central Z, but in order for this to work, you need all spatial boundary terms to vanish. If you want spatial boundary terms to vanish, you can no longer integrate over the sphere because you have poles. You have to do contour integrals separately. So that's a technical thing, which I have not fully understood what it means in terms of numbers. But it is clear that if you can do that, then you can build this extended structure. Somehow you imagine that instead of integrating over the sphere, you begin to do contour integrals, maybe in the complex case, separate contour integrals for zeta and zeta bar. If you are allowed to do that, there is a well-defined, well, in the context of operator vertex algebras, then it is clear that if you have d of something and you take this integration, then the boundary terms do vanish and you get this structure. This is what I can say at this case. So if you do that and you do separate contour integrals, and then you take this expression, then you can put in modes, you can begin to do all the modes, and then you can work out what are these central extensions. And then you begin to see the standard central extensions that you have in conformal field theory, except that the number which would be here, which is a constant in the case of 2D CFTs, is a certain component of the asymptotic part of the shear. That's how it works. Okay, and then you are very excited because you say, now I can do the standard cardiology and say I can reproduce the entropy of the Kerr black hole from null infinity by using this central extension. And then you look at what happens for Kerr, and it turns out that unfortunately, the sigma zero is zero for Kerr. So you are not very lucky in that case because at least from the point of view of null infinity, you cannot reproduce this Bekenstein-Hawking entropy by playing this Cardi formula magic. Right? Okay, but then nevertheless, since you invested so much time to get this, you try to make you try to make sense of it in a certain way. And there is a very nice and easy way to get a non-vanishing sigma zero, of course, is just to copy again what happens in conformal field theory. You say, what happens if Scry is no longer the sphere, but it is a cylinder? Let us map this thing to a cylinder. Let us take this elementary thing from the CFT books and see what happens. And you know exactly how the energy momentum tensor goes when you go from the plane to the cylinder. There is a constant shift, in fact, which is the constant shift comes from the integrated version of this formula here. Okay, this is where it comes. And when you do that here, it is no surprise that then suddenly both the news and the asymptotic part of the shear just get shifted, and you get a non-zero value. Of course, if you want to use it to say something about entropy, then you need to argue why you should be on the cylinder, and I have to say I have no idea why that would be the case, but of course it must be the case. No, this is the speculation, but this is speculation, but the formulas are as they are. They are good, I think they are kind of interesting, and what to do with them is still, I would say, at least here, work in progress. Maybe let me tell you that nowadays people do the same kind of game at the horizon of the Kerr black hole, and apparently they have new results in that direction. So this is the recent work. But nevertheless, I should also say that it's very similar to doing the derivation for the BTZ black hole from the... I mean, there's nothing new with respect to that, at least from what I could. Okay, so this was the first part of the talk. So this was supposed to be 30 minutes, but it's a bit more. So now it depends what you want to hear more. I can talk about either the integrated transformations where you see Schwarzian derivatives, really full-fledged Schwarzian derivatives instead of seeing infinitesimal Schwarzian derivatives. Or I can talk about three dimensions if people are interested in that. But three dimensions are really like the old result. It's much less complicated. The symmetry groups are more like really, let's say, the 2D conformal algebra. And the central extensions are really numbers and not fields. So from that point of view, it's easier to talk. So anything you would like to hear, maybe not the construction of conserved charges, because this is... okay. So
and finite BMS.
Finite BMS. Okay. Let me talk about finite BMS, but maybe not. See. Well, this we had already, all of them. Finite BMS. So the idea is the same then for the infinitesimal transformation. Somebody gives you this ansatz and which tells you, let us solve Einstein's equation by fixing these gauge conditions and these fall-off conditions. So then you ask which infinitesimal transformation leave all your conditions invariant. Now you are asking, and it's technically interesting to do it in a first-order formalism because sometimes things simplify with respect to the second-order formalism. So you are asking in the Newman-Penrose or in a Cartan formulation, it's the same thing, which gauge symmetries leave your ansatz invariant? And you ask which finite transformations do you have. So you can either do it like that or try to integrate the transformations by integrating them up. There's really two ways. And in this case, it turns out it's quite useful to just do the gravitational problem again and do it like that. If you do that for ADS3 gravity, you do this exercise, you really find the Schwarzian derivative, the full Schwarzian derivative just from ADS3 gravity without having to know something. It's really a neat application of ADS3 CFT2, I would say, which is really by standard gravitational techniques find the Schwarzian derivative in the transformation of the energy momentum tensor. Not surprising, but it's neat, I would say. And here you do the same thing. We will also do something else, which is allow for Weyl rescalings. And this is just because if you allow for Weyl rescalings, you do not have to squeeze all these solutions that you are interested in into this BMS gauge. So if you fix your Weyl rescalings, then you have to put all gravitational solutions you're interested in BMS gauge. For instance, these Robinson-Trautmann solutions, you would first need to put them into BMS gauge before applying to, before seeing what happens. But it turns out that you can do the full formalism So I should tell you that the Robinson-Trautmann solution has not a conformal factor which is one in front of the spherical part of the metric, but all the dynamics is in this conformal factor. And that's why it's kind of interesting to have an extension of the formalism which fixes the gauge a bit less, but which does this Weyl transformation. Okay, and then, so these are these Weyl transformations. You're not surprised that the superrotations become coordinate, so chiral coordinate transformation in this complex coordinate that we have. So this is how the superrotations integrate. The supertranslations are just determined by a factor which depends on zeta and zeta bar. They are not so difficult to integrate because they are abelian. So that part is easy. And maybe let me go quickly to our best formula. See, this is really ugly formulas. So probably the best formula is the transformation law of the Bondi mass aspect. So this is the Bondi mass aspect when you compute it on the plane and not on the sphere. So this was what we had before. It was psi 0 2 plus sigma 0 sigma bar 0. It's exactly the same thing. So when you look at how this transforms under the integrate transformation, you see that it has a certain weight, 3/2, which you can already see from the infinitesimal transformations. But then the new stuff is this Schwarzian derivative, which tells you how the Bondi mass aspect transforms with, for instance, the asymptotic part of the shear and this object. So, for instance, let me say, in one of these papers by Strominger and Perry and Hawking, they were saying, the Bondi mass does not change if you do a supertranslation. Can you see that on this formula? So that's the question. Can you see that the Bondi mass is unaffected by supertranslations? So if you only do supertranslations, these guys are not there because you are not doing superrotations, so you're doing none of the psi primes. Okay. Then you find that all of these objects are absent, and you take the integral of this over the sphere, if you want. And then you see that this is proportional to a total derivative which will vanish on the sphere. So what I'm trying to illustrate is that this formula contains this kind of information. And this formula, you will also not be surprised, because this was just the new tensor, and it had exactly the weights of a stress energy tensor. And so this one goes really with the standard Schwarzian derivative when you integrate. So this is how the gravitational solution space transforms under the finite version of the asymptote. Then you can organize it into orbits, and you can try to see which solutions are related by symmetries, and which, if you can classify your orbits, you know what part of your solution space, how many orbits you have. If you play this game in three dimensions, it's kind of really interesting, because you see coadjoint orbits, and they are completely classified, so you can really say something about your solution space. You can organize it much better. Very good. We were very proud with the Schwarzian derivatives, and we were thinking that nobody had ever seen them in gravity, but of course that's never true. So Zibodoyev found a paper which has very much to do with this, because it describes solutions which are singular, in fact, on the sphere, which have wireless singularities. And you can see that the very construction of this solution, of course, they really had, it has these Schwarzian derivatives built in. So maybe we were not the first one to see these transformation laws, but maybe we have worked them out in a bit more generality than that. But so what I'm trying to say is that there are really solutions. So this solution is built out of Minkowski space by doing a non-trivial transformation on it. And you see the same kind of things happening. So there's much to be understood, but I think it can tell you that it could be interesting to do this kind of objects.
If you do that and you follow it through inside You say you have singularity and infinity. Do you have also singularity inside?
Yes. So maybe to answer that question, it's good to see what happens in three dimensions. Uh-huh. Maybe let me stop with that, because then I can answer quantitatively. And so, this is a remark of, this is an apology that I'm not doing quantization. So there are good examples of people talking about quantum mechanics where everything is classical. And then I should also say that this has to do something with quantization. These old approaches, those asymptotic quantization, are very much related to but of course this is just an apology because it's a quantum gravity seminar. So if you do this in three-dimensional gravity, everything is much easier. If you do your gauge fixing ansatz, you can solve both in the ADS case and in the flat case your equations exactly by hand. And you find that the general solution depends on two arbitrary functions in both cases. One's of x plus and x minus, and in the flat case of phi in that case. And then you can ask, and that's your question, what do these solutions represent? So this is, you put asymptotic conditions, you solve your equations, and now you ask what is in your phase space? What kind of singularities are there? And when you look at them, you can look at the easiest solutions, which are the solution where these arbitrary functions are constant. And then you find that the solution where these arbitrary functions are constants are solutions, of course, which have singularities inside, all of them, because they have non-trivial charges, if you want, so they better have something which produces this charge, some singularities which produce them. So when these arbitrary functions are constant in the anti-de Sitter case, you find that you have BTZ black holes, you have angular defect solutions of these angular defect solutions of Deser, Jakeev, Templeton, for some values of M and J. This thing is not completely correct because the defects, it's not a straight line, it's an asymptote which goes like that, and there are excess solutions there. And then you can look at what happens when you take the flat limit, or what happens in the flat case. Then you find that this three-dimensional solution, what happens if you take the cosmological constant to infinity, is that the outer horizon gets pushed to infinity. I should say the cosmological constant to zero, the radius to infinity. The outer horizon gets pushed to zero, to infinity, but the inner horizon stays put. So what happens is that this thing opens up, and instead of the black holes, you have the interior of the BTZ black hole, which you can identify with a cosmological solution. It becomes a cosmological horizon. And you have the angular defect solutions in flat space and the excess solutions in anti-de Sitter space. So what you have done is only looking at the problem asymptotically, but then you need to analyze the solutions to see what kind of singularities are inside. And these are examples of these singularities inside in 3D.
Okay. There are lines like codimension 2. Is it the same structure?
I have not analyzed them. One should. I don't.
Two, one.
It's not clear to me. In this case, it's clear because people have analyzed these geometries and they know what they are. They are world. So, for instance, for the defects, they are world lines of particles in the Chan-Simons formulation. They are Wilson loops, in fact, of the. So that's kind of clear, I would say.
It would be most likely more word sheets.
Could be. Maybe an interesting thing would be to look at this Penrose and Nutku paper and see what kind of singularity it really is, and they must have discussed it. But I'm not an expert on that. Okay, maybe let me stop here.
Has any of this been applied to the C metric for accelerating black holes to understand EMS conserved charges, all that kind of
thing? How they work on this solution, inside there? I didn't play with it. Maybe some of it has, maybe one has to look in, probably, maybe in the paper by Zibodoyev and Strominger, they have done some of that, but I'm not completely sure. I don't know. So. good, everything was clear.
Right, then let's think.
I have a question, maybe, I mean, you said the advantage of not having, you know, you have these local charges, but at some point you show that, you know, at some point we use these charges because we integrate them and then we have conservation fluxes.
Mm-hmm.
Right, so, I mean, what's possible then with this super? I mean, you cannot really, so you have this generator, but then you don't have any conservation associated with it. Is there any memory, you're looking for some kind of physical effect?
Yes, yes, well, they okay, since it is not my work that I've not been talking about, but they have been used to say something about subleadings of theorems, for instance. Like in, so they have been used. But they are not well-defined charges in the GR sense that you can integrate over them. But you know, when you do... In correlation functions, you have no problems in having poles and stuff like that. So it is more in that direction that they... So they have been used. I also should say that the finite transformations, I think what you can use them for is... So imagine that you have worked out a gravitational solution where sky is a sphere. Then you can do one of these finite transformations, and just from... You don't need to recompute the solution again. You just get how the solution looks when you change sky and you put it to a cylinder just by applying the transformation. And you can see that on toy mode. So it's like correlation functions. Once you have computed them on the plane, somehow the power of the formalism gives you what they look like on different spaces. And here, what is correlation functions, I would say, corresponds to gravitational solutions. In some sense, you can use them for that. You can use them for soft theorems, or has been used for soft theorems. It's not so clear. And there's all these discussions that you would need super translations in higher dimensions to derive the soft theorems also. From that thing, even if from a gravitational point of view, you have stronger fall-off conditions that would say that there might be not super translations in higher dimensions. But this depends, I would say, on the game you are playing. And the rules of the game are maybe not completely fixed yet.
Have you looked at these shockwave solutions?
No, I didn't. But this impulsive gravitational waves, I think I like that. I have not really played with solutions. I mean, already we have struggled to put the Kerr in BMS gauge and all this kind of thing. And but still, I have not played because I've more played with the algebra. But I think all these things can be done. And these gauges are reachable, and even if you relax them. One very interesting thing to play with is Robinson-Trautmann solutions, in my opinion, because they fit nicely in this framework when you do this wild transformation in addition. These are the ones that I would really love to look at. And then you really have also, you have fluxes and non-conservation, and it settles down. So this is the one I would love to play. And also, they have, as far as I remember, but I'm not an expert, they have some singularities as well, right?
The
Robinson-Trautmann.
Right, thank you.